North Korea is the impossible state. It's a place that stumped leaders and policymakers for more than three decades. It has a complex history, and it has become the United States' top national security priority. Each week on this show, we'll talk with the people who know the most about North Korea.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Impossible State podcast. This is Victor Cha, Senior Vice President for Asia and Korea Chair at CSIS, Vice Dean and Professor at Georgetown. I'm subbing in for Andrew Schwartz, who is our Senior Vice President for Communications at CSIS. He normally hosts the show with me as one of the participants, but today I'm going to play the role of both participant and host. And we are joined on the podcast today by our very special guest, Jenny Town. For any of you who are remotely familiar with the DC policy community when it comes to Korea, you will know that Jenny Town is a rising star in this field, or more appropriately, I don't even think you're a rising star anymore. I think you're a risen star, as she has been on the scene really for more than a decade now. So let me properly introduce her. Jenny Town is a senior fellow at the Stimson Center and director of the Stimson Center's 38 North program. She was named one of Worth Magazine's Groundbreakers 2020, 50 Women Changing the World, and one of Fast Company's Most Creative People in Business in 2019 for her role in co-founding and managing the 38 North website, which provides policy and technical analysis on North Korea. Ms. Town is also an expert reviewer for Freedom House's Freedom in the World Index, where she previously worked on the Human Rights in North Korea project, an associate fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, a member of the National Committee on North Korea, and an associate member of the Council of Korean Americans. She serves on the editorial board for Inkstick, an online foreign policy journal for emerging scholars. She holds a BA in East Asian Studies and International Relations from Westmore University and a Master's of International Relations from Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. When did you graduate from Columbia, Jenny?
2008.
I also went to SIPA before it was even called SIPA. At that time, it was called only the School of International Affairs. There was no public affairs, and Columbia College may still have been all male at that time as well. So it was quite a long time ago. Anyway, Jenny, welcome to the Impossible State. I thought we'd start by talking about Vice President Harris's trip to the region. As we all know, she's headed to the region to represent the United States at the funeral for Shinzo Abe. She will also in the region be visiting Korea probably later this week. I think it's Thursday this week. At the same time, we have the USS Ronald Reagan in the region for military drills. And then North Korea recently flew a short-range ballistic missile. So I guess I want to start out by getting your thoughts on the current situation. Do you think there's anything that will come out of this visit? Anything that we should be watching out for?
I have my doubts that there's anything significant that will come from this meeting. I think it is good political signaling and helps convey the sense that despite everything else going on, that South Korea, that Asia is still a priority for the U.S., a foreign policy priority, because I do think there is a lot of concern in the region that the U.S. is just really distracted dealing with the war in Ukraine, dealing with domestic issues, especially the hyper partisanship here in D.C. and all of the turmoil that that's coming from. I do think while she's there, she's probably going to hear a lot of complaints about the Inflation Reduction Act and what South Korea believes are discriminatory policies in that realm. But overall, I think, you know, again, it just helps give the sense that the U.S. is, you know, committed to the alliance at a time of high tensions in the region. So I do think the political signaling is important.
This is certainly her first trip to Korea as vice president. Her husband was the administration's representative at the unveiling of the new war memorial. And that, frankly, met with mixed reviews. I think there were some who felt like, certainly on the Korean side, who felt like a higher level representative should come. Not that the vice president's spouse is not high level, but comparable to what the Koreans brought the defense minister and the minister for veteran affairs. And we didn't have many members of Congress there either. I think Dan Sullivan was there and maybe one other. So, but I doubt you'll hear anything about that. But the trip to the region, it's, as you say, it's very important for the United States to maintain some steady tempo of representation with the region, given all else that is going on in the world. You sort of suggested it, but what is your sense in terms of how the Koreans are thinking about the Inflation Reduction Act and whether they're confident that there'll be any sort of resolution or solution that'll be satisfactory to them?
You know, I think there's definitely a sense of betrayal that's been expressed on the South Korean side. I think there's a real frustration here in Washington also of they should have seen some of it coming and there should be some things that they should understand. So I think at this point, the U.S. has expressed the willingness to look at some of these provisions. I don't know what that appetite in Congress is, how congressional members are viewing this. Even those that are very pro-alliance, I don't think they understand the full impact on sort of alliance cohesion and alliance psychology that this conveys. But whether or not there's confidence that we will get resolution, I don't think there's confidence we'll get resolution anytime soon, but it'll certainly be a point of active debate and discussion and tensions in the near future.
I'm sure it'll be the first thing that she hears about. Sure, they'll talk about extended deterrence and they'll talk about Japan and they'll talk about China, but at least it looks like the talking points of every Korean official from right. The working level to the very highest level, the first talking point is IRA. And I agree with you. I don't imagine that there's some near-term solution. I mean, this is, you know, trying to seek exemptions for legislation is never an easy thing. It requires the national security side of the White House to talk to the domestic side. It's difficult and it's messy, but I think they'll continue to raise it. I'm certain that Vice President Harris will get an earful about it. You mentioned earlier that part of the reason it's good to have people like the vice president going to the region and going to Korea is to show that we're so focused on the region because of distractions in other places, particularly the war in Europe. How do you think that the war in Europe and also the situation in the Taiwan Straits, because that's the other thing, right? Here in D.C., as we know well, the two issues that are sucking all the oxygen out of the room is the war in Europe and, you know, what China's intentions are on the Taiwan Straits. How do you think that this is all affecting the policy towards Korea?
I think there's a lot of impact here. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I don't think we fully understand, you know, the full ramifications of what's happened yet. The idea that a nuclear weapon state has attacked a non-nuclear weapon state and threatened to use nuclear weapons really does break that social and actual legal contract. You know, as one of the NPT members, as one of the P5 NPT members. And I think it's really reinvigorated this notion and revived this notion that the only thing that would prevent a nuclear armed state, a nuclear weapon state from attacking another state is nuclear weapons. And so there has been rising support for instance, for South Korea building their own nuclear weapons. There's rising public support. I think this is a conversation that's going to get more support going forward. I think the U.S.-China tensions are and the fears about Taiwan are not only the fears of, you know, conflict breaking out in Taiwan, but more so the resource allocation that would go towards that in the case of actual conflict and what happens if North Korea does something at that point in time, right? Can the U.S. be distracted from, can U.S. resources be tied up if North Korea were to attack, whether it was a coordinated China-North Korea effort or whether it was, you know, North Korea being opportunistic at that moment to do something, knowing that, you know, the resource allocation would be much more difficult of, you know, where would the U.S. put its attention? Can it really fight a two-front conflict in Asia? And so I think all of these contingencies are becoming much more real, as well as the idea that North Korea has recently announced a new nuclear law, a new nuclear doctrine that is also, you know, authorizing the use or discussing its strategy of preemptive nuclear strikes. You know, all of these things really raise the possibility of nuclear weapons being used in the region, of nuclear conflict breaking out, and of, you know, a lot of questions of how prepared are we for this sort of new range of contingencies that haven't really seemed that plausible in recent decades. So, you know, there's just a lot of real anxiety that's rising, and it's fueling, you know, not only an arms race in the region, but also, you know, a more serious consideration in South Korea about whether they need to cross the nuclear threshold.
So on that last point, I mean, what's your sense? I mean, we know it used to be sort of very much of a fringe far right sort of argument, I think probably most visibly associated with Chung Mong-jun, right, MJ Chung. Right. Where do you feel on the political spectrum that discussion is today?
Well, it's definitely much more mainstream. The public support is pretty overwhelming. I've seen polls anywhere from like 7 out of 10 people to 9 out of 10 people who have been in favor of South Korea having nuclear weapons. And the interesting thing is it's not an either or situation. It's not that they have low confidence in the United States. I think public polls show that, you know, the South Korean public has still very high confidence in the United States. They have high confidence in, you know, U.S. troops on the ground and on the strength of the alliance, but they also have high public support for South Korea having nuclear weapons. So it isn't this, if we have the right mix of, you know, U.S. alliance capabilities, it will calm the anxieties enough to prevent this push for nuclear weapons. I think right now what we're seeing is both directions of, you know, there needs to be strong alliance, but also the failsafe of having, I guess, somewhat of a comfort in having command and control of your own nuclear arsenal too, in case of, you know, contingencies, nuclear contingencies from North Korea.
I haven't followed the surveying that closely, but that's an interesting point, because I wonder if the question is ever asked in terms of not both and, but either or. If yes to South Korea and South Korea crossing the nuclear threshold, then one of the costs of that might be a greatly attenuated alliance relationship with the United States. Maybe there won't be troops on the ground. I don't know if the question has been asked as an either or. I mean, if it's asked as a both and, it's pretty easy to answer, right? It's like, yeah, I want both. I want my cake and eat it too. Of course I do, right? But if it's an either or, I wonder, because, you know, that was certainly the trade-off that the United States gave to South Korea in the 70s, right? Do you recall if the survey sort of asked the trade-off question? We can ask Carl and Toby and everybody who did the survey, but I don't remember off the top of my head.
I don't recall any of the questions being posed that way or being posed as to hear the consequences. It's definitely something we should, you know, get Carl to ask in the next survey.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get Carl on the show next time and ask him. How do you think the war in Ukraine and the situation in the Taiwan Straits has affected North Korea and North Korean calculations?
Well, I think, you know, great power competition in general has created a lot of opportunities for North Korea to exploit that bring benefit to them. I think the war in Ukraine, most likely North Korea is learning lessons from both sides. From the Ukrainian side of, you know, if you have nuclear weapons, you're less likely to be attacked. But also, you know, I think there's a sense of, you know, we have nuclear weapons to use them. And, you know, North Korea has less reason to bluff about using them in the future because they don't want to be another Ukraine. And I think you see some of that messaging coming through in the way that they're phrasing things about, you know, potential use of nuclear weapons. And a lot of the talk of preemptions and preemptive strategies came out post Russia's invasion of Ukraine and also in the shadow of President Yoon's rise and him talking about South Korea's adopting a more preemptive doctrine also. But I think, you know, what you have here also is as Russia's pariah status grows because of this violation of international law, it creates new opportunities and greater value to North Korea's political support for Russia, which also comes with benefits, both economic and potentially in terms of technology and arms in the future. We hear lots of rumors of things going, you know, of possible deals being made or North Korea is sending, being willing to send troops or construction workers or other kinds of support to Russia. We hear, you know, reports of like Russian wheat going to North Korea. Certainly there's, you know, in this potential arms deal of North Korea supplying arms to Russia as well, even though both sides have denied it. The high-level political signaling between Putin and Kim Jong-un has created and, you know, the political backing for that kind of cooperation, or as they call it, you know, tactical and strategic cooperation to go forward, even if they're not admitting it. So it really does give North Korea a lot more opportunity to maneuver, as well as, you know, U.S.-China tensions also gives North Korea a lot of opportunities to exploit with its relations with China to get greater benefits for its political support and things that, you know, if it were negotiating with the U.S. would be really difficult, long drawn out negotiations for maybe some meager kinds of benefits, whereas here they can show their support for China and get more immediate benefits in terms of aid and political support and political backing in the international community.
This point that you made about how, you know, tensions between the United States and Russia or the United States and China are seen as opportunities by North Korea. And whereas it's the mirror image for South Korea, right? Whenever tension between the U.S. and Russia, or the U.S. and China, they feel entrapment, right? They feel they're getting pulled in to something that they don't want to get pulled into. So it's almost like they welcome, each Korea welcomes the current situation in a completely different way. The other thing I thought that was interesting is this point about, you know, North Korea's announcement recently, or this law recently with regard to first use, a kind of first use law, if you will. Part of it, you know, I think does have to do with what they saw the Russians say with regard to NATO, to deterring NATO, right, in when they first moved into Ukraine. But it also could be seen as like much more deeply rooted as not just a sort of reflexive tactical response to what the, you know, the Russians' threats to NATO with regard to Ukraine, but going back, you know, they watch the South Korean kill chain strategy, they watch the South Koreans talk about decapitation strikes, and going even further than that, going back to when, you know, the Trump administration was talking about a bloody nose military strike on North Korea. And North Korea probably sees all those things and is trying to signal, look, if you're not certain how we're going to respond, we're going to tell you how we're going to respond so that you never think that we will somehow sit idle if you attack us. And so I agree, like part of it is this response to what they're seeing in Ukraine, but part of it is like they're looking across the border, South Korea's evolving military strategy, and Japan's also, right? Japan is talking about counterstrike capabilities very openly today, and it's probably in response to all that. I mean, this kind of segues well into the third topic I want to discuss with you, and that is sort of the prospects for diplomacy. You know, we have this North Korean announcement of this new law, right, this new first use law. You know, the Biden administration says that it has tried to re-engage with North Korea numerous times, but has not received a response. Where do you think we are? And the Yoon government has said that they're open, right, to talking to North Korea. Where do you think we are on all this? I know that you're expert on the diplomacy, in no small part because you've been involved in quite a lot of track two. Where do you think we are on diplomacy? You know, are the North Koreans interested? If so, when? Is the Biden administration, are they trying hard enough? You know, what's the position of China on all of this? That would be great to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think, you know, we really missed a big opportunity in 2018, 2019 to get an agreement, even if it wasn't for the whole program all at once, get an agreement that would have at least began to set some kind of limits on the program and move the relationship in a more positive direction when North Korea was willing to do it, when North Korea saw a clear benefit in doing so. And we saw Kim Jong-un conveying those messages to the people, building expectations that a breakthrough was coming. And that, you know, that they were committed to denuclearization. He included it in his Princeton 2019 New Year's speech to the people. And he didn't have to actually mention denuclearization on a domestic level for that. I think we lost a lot in doing so. And I think the most important part was we lost, I think North Korea lost this underlying sense that a path towards economic development would open up with better relations with the U.S. And so that attitude or that belief appears to be gone. That moment appears to be over. And so what we heard in late 2019 was really this sense that things with the U.S. weren't going to change, that instead that they had to build greater resilience to a persistently hostile external environment. And so, you know, he really since then has worked to lower expectations, first from that diplomatic failure and then because of the pandemic. But I think what we also lost in that process was I think there was also an underlying belief if we just worked at a high enough level and got, you know, leader to leader contact, that a breakthrough would be quick and it would be far reaching. And I think that's what that's what Kim Jong-un found with Moon in Seoul, that, you know, with the summits, Moon was willing to do a lot, was willing to work quickly, was willing to sort of move mountains for the relationship. But while Trump was willing to meet, which surprised everyone, was willing to make at least that decision quickly, it did not necessarily progress U.S.-North Korea relations in a fundamental and sustainable way. And so, you know, the U.S. was still in this denuclearization-centric approach where progress was still contingent on North Korea committing to specific denuclearization measures, but of which we couldn't agree to, even with high-level political attention and will, what measures were sufficient even for a first step. And so now North Korea has had the experience on a bilateral level of doing working-level negotiations, working-level up. Now they've done top-down, and neither one came to a quick or sustainable solution. They've tried multilateral working groups of the six-party talks. And again, even when they were able to get agreements, they weren't sustainable over time. And so, you know, again, all of this sort of builds the mistrust, it builds the frustration in the process. And, you know, I think what we've seen is now a real fundamental shift in North Korea's foreign policy strategy, where instead of, you know, working on the belief of we have to get sanctions relief in order to do better, instead, it's a much more focused effort on let's cultivate our relations with more sympathetic states, with countries like China, like Russia, but also a range of other countries that they tend to mention in their, you know, UN speeches and stuff, like Venezuela, Syria, Iran, countries that have either kind of shared political values or political history or common enemies at this point, including those under sanctions. And if you look at, you know, the UN panel of experts reports, there's certainly plenty of countries and plenty of actors that are willing to work with them despite the international law and international sanctions against them. So I think it's going to be really difficult to convince North Korea there's a reason to come back to negotiations, knowing that anything coming back will be hard fought. It will be a struggle to get any kind of to a point of actual action. And so I think right now it's also not a very compelling measure because there is an arms race going on and all the other countries around them are arming up. So, you know, why would North Korea in the middle of that be the only one to step in and say, we're going to work on limiting our arms and in order to have better relations with the rest of the region, including South Korea, are developing new missiles and actively testing things that North Korea is prohibited from doing. On the diplomatic side, you know, these messages are always really mixed. This idea that something is possible, but there's no demonstration of the kinds of things that we'd be willing to do. This, you know, talking point of we have no hostile intent. And, you know, at the same time, there's South Korea talking about kill chain and decapitation and, you know, U.S. ROK joint military exercises are going on. So the words have come to mean less and less over time as, you know, the relationship continues to kind of devolve in the wrong direction.
So I take it you don't think the prospects are very good right now.
I don't think they're very good.
I couldn't disagree with you. I don't think they're very good right now either. And, you know, the only path that's really been laid open by both Washington and Seoul is on the humanitarian side, right? I mean, they've both been explicit about the willingness to do things on food and on medical health, separate from denuclearization, but North Korea is not interested in taking that bait right now. You alluded in your previous answer, and this will be the last topic I wanted to chat with you about today on the podcast. You alluded in your previous answer, there's sort of a dynamic in the region now, diplomatically, that is sort of heading in the wrong direction, but in terms of what countries are doing in terms of their military capabilities is moving in the opposite direction. I know that you all are working on a project on this at the center. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about it or preview what you guys are doing?
Yeah. So, you know, we've been looking at all these trends in the region, especially that are kind of fueled by U.S., China, U.S., Russia, great power rivalry. And, you know, this includes all the great powers going through nuclear modernization campaigns, modernization and expansion. You have South Korea and Japan increasing defense budgets, increasing missile capabilities. You have, obviously, North Korea on a pretty intensive R&D kick. So all of this, you know, this sort of arms racing in the region as the political dynamics are getting worse, you know, I think trying to better understand first the threshold of what kind of armaments are useful versus those that further agitate the situation. But our goal is really to look at the arms race in the region, one, and project out what it might look at like in, say, 5 years. What is the worst case scenario? What is the best case scenario and kind of in between? And then how do we build an agenda of tension reduction, risk reduction, confidence building, and arms control measures that we might try to employ or that might be necessary in the region to prevent that worst case scenario from coming to life? And so that's really where our research is going over the next year or so, trying to do a number of dialogues in the region to understand country threat perceptions. Like, do we have a common understanding of what the worst case actually is? and if not, what are those areas of divergence? And what do you know, the various countries want to see happen in the region? What would they be willing to do? And again, tailored to kind of where on the spectrum we end up being, tailoring these mitigation measures to the spectrum of worst case to best case scenarios, knowing that different things will be feasible under different conditions.
It sounds like a very interesting project. You know, it reminds me of how, you know, right after the end of the Cold War, you had all of these international relations scholars talking about how there was going to be conflict in Asia and an arms buildup and all this stuff. And that would be the next arena of great power conflict. And then that never happened. And then these IR scholars were kind of stumped. And then all these IR/Asia scholars then tried to explain why there was peace, why there wasn't conflict in Asia. But now we seem, the point of all this is now we seem to be entering a phase where, you know, as your project suggests, we are seeing some of the things that people were worried about at the end of the Cold War in terms of, you know, spiraling insecurities, right? Arms buildups and all this. And so this project seems like very appropriately timed and a good one to sort of foster dialogue across, you know, different countries, different experts in countries. So sounds like a great project. Thanks, Jenny. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us, Jenny, on The Impossible State. We hope we can stay in touch and hear more about the project as it comes to fruition.
Thanks, Victor. It's great to be here.
And to our listeners, thank you for listening to another episode of The Impossible State. We will be back with you again in about 2 weeks with our next show. Thanks, everybody. Have a good day.
If you have a question for one of our experts about The Impossible State, email us at impossiblestate@csis.org. If you want to dive deeper into the issues surrounding North Korea, check out Beyond Parallel. That's our micro website that's dedicated to bringing a better understanding of the Korean Peninsula. You can find it at beyondparallel.csis.org. And don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That's so more listeners can find us. It's very helpful. We're now also streaming on Spotify, so you can find us there too, where you find all your music. How cool is that? And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This is The Impossible State.